This is Rom, the space knight. You can imagine he comes from another galaxy with his flashing neutralizer. Activate Rom. You can imagine he has rockets to blast into space and a translator that communicates with lights and sounds. You can even imagine his respirator lets him breathe in any atmosphere. Rom comes with the three plug-in accessories shown. 9-volt battery not included. Rom, the space knight, an electronic toy new from Parker Brothers.
Hello, and welcome to a special episode of FW Presents, the anthology show of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Today, we are celebrating some of the exciting works by the amazingly talented comic book writer Bill Mantlo. Now, for this episode, I'm one of your hosts, the Irredeemable Shag, and I am joined by fellow network all-stars, Rob Kelly.
I'm going to need that arm.
Ryan Daly.
Insert my obligatory I've never heard of Bill Mantlo before today joke.
Perfect. And Max Romero.
I have nothing interesting to say.
Oh, that's not true. That's not true at all. Folks, we love celebrating our favorite creators. And we recently did tribute episodes after losing the wonderfully talented Marty Pasco and Denny O'Neill. And Ryan spearheaded a fantastic episode talking about the amazing Roger Stern, who thankfully is still with us. So we're making a conscious effort to celebrate some of our favorite creators and not wait for tragedy to hit. So today we are going to be talking about Bill Mantlo, who is just an amazing, amazing writer. Now, I'm going to go around the horn here, guys. I'm going to ask you, what was your first experience with Bill Mantlo as far as comics goes, and what made you fall in love with his work? Rob, we're going to start with you, buddy.
Okay, well, so I was going through his biography on Mike's Amazing World, or his whatever you would call it, his creator, what would be that word? His
bibliography,
I guess. Yeah, his list of comics that he wrote. And I mean, look, I honestly can't remember the first Bill Mantlo story I read, because there was, out of the several hundred books listed, I probably read half of them. And so I was amazed at just how many different things he wrote that I did read. Vision and Scarlet Witch, he wrote Incredible Hulk, he wrote the Jack of Hearts miniseries, which every artist hates, right? Drawing. I mean, he did. He wrote the Incredible Hulk versus Quasimodo one-shot. I mean, he wrote all kinds of crazy stuff. And it was sort of funny when we were thinking about what stories we wanted to cover. I initially was going to go with Incredible Hulk number 261, where Hulk fights the Absorbing Man, because that is one of my single favorite one-and-dones of all time. And then
sounds familiar.
Right. And then I remembered that Ryan and I actually covered that on a Find Your Joy. And funny enough, that episode is the first time Ryan actually did hear Bill Mantlo. That was actually true.
Oh.
So I had to go back and find something else. And there was so much to pick from. So I honestly do not remember when I first saw this guy, but I'm sure it was a name like all these other names we've been talking about, where it was always just sort of in the back of my head of like, oh, Bill Mantlo, I know that name. Okay, great. And there is a ton of really fun stuff in his career. So I'm really glad we're getting a chance to do this. And I'm glad I'm on an episode that's not a memorial episode. I'm just happy
right.
about that.
Right. All right, Ryan. So other than this is the first time you've ever heard of Bill Mantlo, how'd you find him and what made you fall in love with him?
So like Rob, I went to the Mike's Amazing World as the resource just to kind of look at his whole bibliography or whatever, his creator credits. And I was shocked that the first time I would have experienced his work in comics was actually his first published work for Marvel. And it was Werewolf by Night 22. Now, he didn't write that book. He was the colorist, because for like the first like year or so of his career, he was just working as a colorist before he got writing jobs. Now, I read that book out back in the 70s and everything, but I read it in the early 90s, I think it was. But I was a kid, and I got this like shoebox full of old Tomb of Dracula and Werewolf by Night comics. Incidentally, it is actually like one of my very favorite issues in the run, and I love Werewolf by Night, so it was kind of an auspicious thing. But I had no idea. Like back then, I never paid attention to the credits. I didn't know who Doug Munch or Don Perlin was. I none of those names meant anything to me. But I just thought it was kind of funny that when I saw it, I was like, that was his first book. He colored that book. And I was like, I love that issue. And I do remember reading that in the stack of Werewolf by Nights. Beyond that, though, he was really under my radar, or just like kind of out of range. I didn't read a whole lot of his stuff. Like I didn't read his Hulk run. That was before I was reading the Hulk. And I didn't know his stuff was Spider-Man or Alpha Flight at the time. Most of his work was before I got into comics. But just within the last couple of years, I have been backfilling a bunch of 70s and 80s Marvel through Marvel Unlimited and some other trades and filling out. And I did a whole long read through, partially based on when I think, Rob, you also talked about one of his issues of The Incredible Hulk on a Mountain Comics episode.
Yes, covered, like, number 300. Yeah.
And it sounded so great. I was like, I got to read this whole thing. So I read the Mantlo Buscema run of The Incredible Hulk, and I loved it. And then, you know, I read, like, the Deathlock stories from Astonishing Tales, which were, like, plotted and drawn by Rich Buckler, but Mantlo wrote the script for a couple of them. And so, yeah, I had been kind of just going back and through his stuff. And so, yeah, my love for the guy and his work is much more recent, but I dig him. I mean, I think he's written some really, really incredible comics.
And Max, what about you, buddy?
Okay, well, this is going to sound a little bit like a cop-out, but I don't really remember when I first read Mantlo, because I think I was always kind of reading Mantlo without really realizing it, because I'm sure I probably read some of his Spider-Man stuff. I'm positive I probably read his Hulk stuff, but I don't think I really noticed them, because I'm the kind of reader who, you know, if I'm reading the paper or the magazine, I don't notice the bylines necessarily. And it's the same kind of, it's kind of the same with comics until, you know, the last, you know, couple of 20, you know, last 20 years or so, I was reading the stories and not necessarily following writers. But I did go back and look at, you know, I like you guys were talking about, I looked back at his bibliography, and I noticed that a lot of my favorite comics and a lot of my favorite stories were written by Mantlo. And I think probably the first time I really noticed him as a writer was the Vision and Scarlet Witch four-part miniseries in 1982, particularly the first issue of that, which takes place on Halloween. And in that story, a malevolent force possesses some kids and turns them into, you know, a demonic scarecrow and a ghost. And I distinctly remember this scene of Vision fighting with that ghost, you know, and that really stuck with me. And I think from there, I started paying attention to Mantlo, because another one of my favorites is Cloak and Dagger, the four-part miniseries of that, because, you know, at the time, Marvel was very big into these four-parters. And that was my introduction to Cloak and Dagger. Rocket Raccoon, which was another four-part miniseries, was written by him. And later, when I started getting into Deadly Hands of Kung Fu and Iron Fist and that sort of thing, that is not true. I was about to say that introduced me to White Tiger, but that's not true. I think I probably read White Tiger for the first time in a Spider-Man comic. And that meant a lot to me, because, you know, this was the first time I had seen a Hispanic superhero, a Latino superhero. So, you know, like I said, if I had to point to one thing that probably stuck with me, it was probably that first issue of the Vision and Scarlet Witch four-parter. But he's written some of my favorite storylines, and he has created some of my favorite characters. I mean, he created all these characters that I just, except with the exception of the Vision and Scarlet Witch, he created Cloak and Dagger and Rocket Raccoon and White Tiger. And, you know, Rom, you know, and the Human Fly, who I'll be talking about later, you know, he did all these things. And I think part of the reason I'm so attracted to Mantlo is the same reason I'm attracted to Bob Haney, is that it is just nuts. It's just crazy stuff. And, it's out there, and it's just really kind of, joyous and imaginative, and it's just a lot of fun to read, and that's what got me into comics in the first place.
I'm glad you mentioned Rocket Raccoon and Cloak and Dagger. I mean, think about the Marvel IP and the money they've made off just off those sets of characters alone, with, you know, merchandising and TV shows and movies. Oh my gosh. Now for me, my first Bill Mantlo comic, I knew exactly what comic it was. At least the first one I recognized that it was, that there was a writer here I wanted to pay attention to. It was Incredible Hulk number 312. Now, I'm not going to talk much about it right now, because I know Ryan wants to talk about it a little bit later. But and the only reason I even read it was because it was a Secret Wars 2 crossover. So, because I was one of those kids that, hey guys, crossovers work. I bought every Secret Wars 2 crossover, including any book I never had bought before. And that's how I got the Hulk issue. That's also how I got my first Micronauts issue. It's also how I got my first Alpha Flight issue, by the way. And it's really powerful. And when we get to it a little bit later, it made me pay attention, and I've reread it a few times, and it made me go, this writer means something. This guy did something to me. He affected me, and it was really powerful. After that, though, as far as what made me fall in love, it was Alpha Flight. When I read his run on Alpha Flight, I was like, oh, you know, because I love the John Byrne run, and there's a lot to love about the Mailman run. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And in the more recent years, the thing that's really captured my imagination is Micronauts. I have become a huge fan of Micronauts, and that's all down to Bill Mantlow. And one of the things that I love about this guy, right, like, nowadays you pick up a comic, right, a new one off the shelf, or heck, even go back to the 90s and pick up one of those, you can read a comic in 5 minutes for the most part. Nowadays, maybe 3 minutes, the way it takes to take a comic. If I'll get crude here. You know, some people keep a stack of comics in the bathroom, right? And they read a few comics in the bathroom. If you take a Bill Mantlow comic, you're only going to need one of them because it takes a long time to get through a Bill Mantlow comic. It is very dense. There's a lot of story. There's a lot of word balloons.
What a loving tribute.
I realized the rabbit hole I was falling down as that was happening. I just couldn't swerve. Anyway, it is a – I mean, you could – let's take it a lunch hour. Let's say you take your lunch hour and you bring – you don't really need to bring a stack of comics. You just bring one Mantlow comic. It's too late. Anyway. They're really amazing, dense reads, and you get a hell of a lot of story, and it's so worth it. So what an amazing guy. Now, he's still, as we said, folks, he's still with us. Unfortunately, though, Bill's, if you're not aware, back in 1992, he had been struck by a car while he was rollerblading. It was a hit and run. They never found the guy who did it. Mm-hmm. Severe head trauma and resulted in brain damage, and it's been irreparable. He's severely curtailed his entire daily activities. He's basically bedridden in a healthcare facility. His brother took care of him for the last, 30 years until his brother passed away just recently. So it's a very, very sad story for this amazing creative man. But let's not dwell on where he is now. You know, just all keep him in our thoughts. And there's not a fundraiser for him right now. But if anyone comes across one, please put it in the comments. Let's, you know, keep our eyes on that. But for now, let's celebrate his amazing, amazing works. So, you know, we've talked about Rocket Raccoon. We've talked about Cloak and Dagger. You know, he's also, you know, very primarily attached to Micronauts and ROM. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned White Tiger. I mean, the creation of the first Hispanic superhero, that's a huge deal, right, Max?
It was to me, yeah.
And he did that when he was writing The Sons of Tiger. The Deadly Hands of Kung Fu series, that's right. Basically it was a fill-in script. I don't know if you know the story on this one, but the guy who's plotting that book came to him and basically said, I'm going to give you a plot. I need you to write this overnight. And if the guy didn't write it overnight, I think it was Tony Isabella, it just wasn't going to happen. And so that's where Mantlow learned to say, sure, I'll do it. And he did it, and that ended up leading him down this path of being a big-time comic book writer.
And if I can just interject really quickly, I mean, a lot of people are I've been in preparation for this. I've been reading articles about Mantlow, and a lot of them talk about how he was this fill-in artist. And I've even seen some people lean toward calling him a hack because of his speed and because, you know, and all that. But I don't think a hack could turn out so many beloved characters and take so many things that were licensed products, basically, and turn them into an epic like ROM or something like Micronauts, which, you know, is still loved by readers today. I think Bill Mantlow was far from being a hack.
I think one could argue he was a bit of a jobber, perhaps, you know, when he wasn't doing a giant epics like ROM or Micronauts, he did do a lot of fill-ins, and that's not a bad thing. You know, the guy had a 20-year career in comics. He wrote for more than 65 different titles, everything from horror to kung fu to science fiction to mystery to superheroes. I mean, the guy did everything. So sure, he was a jobber to some extent, but that's the job, right? You're a gun for hire to make, you know, to write a story. So
if you look through those of his comics, it is amazing how many like licensed tie-in books he did. And I don't know whether that was Marvel assigned him these things or he took them on, but that's a tough get for any writer to like write Sectars. Try and write a comic about a toy line that nobody remembers and nobody liked at the time. I mean, he really took on a lot of probably tough gigs, and I will get to this when I get to my comic about that. Some of them, he really made them sing, and that takes a lot of skill. And, you know, I think we're all, I don't know, we don't want to be too much of a get off my lawn kind of thing here at the network in general. But I don't know. I think I am a little tired of like comic creators as rock stars kind of thing, because it's just like, oh, you know, this new creator comes on and then 3 issues later, they have an argument with the editor and they're gone. some of these runs that he had on these titles are amazing. I kind of like that. I like some of the consistent creativity that he showed to be able to crank this stuff out day in, day out. That's really impressive.
And he did so many different – I mean, like, he wrote the first work on Daredevil that Frank Miller ever drew. I mean, you know, so the guy touched everything. And related, you mentioned the network and all that. You know, he's actually wrote something important to the network. He was the scripter on the Invasion miniseries. I didn't even realize that.
Let's not hold that against him,
Shane. Oh, that's a totally get off my lawn thing, because Rob stopped caring about comics at that point. Oh, my gosh. That's terrible. Well, you know, let's talk about a couple of great books that he's done real quickly while we mention our sponsors. Folks, this episode of FW Presents is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Now, we picked a couple of books to talk about that Mantlo wrote that just are things that we really enjoy. Ryan, you want to go first?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about the book, sort of previewing what I'm going to be talking about later. I picked Cloak and Dagger, Shadows and Light trade paperback. The description is, Cloak and Dagger step out of the darkness and into the light, but will this pair of violent vigilantes be friends or foes to the Spectacular Spider-Man? The young duo's war on drugs will put crime bosses Silvermane and Kingpin in their sights, with the wall crawler stuck in the middle. Then follow Tyrone Johnson and Tandy Bowen into their own uncanny adventures and discover what set them on their dark path. Detective O'Reilly wants to arrest them, Father Delgado wants to reform them, but does anyone really understand them? Plus, after Spidey chaperones their first meeting, Cloak and Dagger face a power struggle with the New Mutants. This trade paperback collects Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man issues 64, 69 and 70, 81 and 82, 94, 95, 96, Cloak and Dagger 1 through 4, Marvel Team Up Annual number 6, Marvel Fanfare 19, and New Mutants 23 through 25. That's like 17 books right there. It was published by Marvel, obviously. The writer is Bill Mantlo, and also Al Milgrom and Chris Claremont chip in. The artists include Ed Hannigan, Al Milgrom, Rick Leonardi, Bill Sienkiewicz, Ron Frenz, and more. The page count is 448 pages. The original price is $34.99, but at in-stock trades, you can get it for $20.29. That's 42% off.
That's awesome. What a great collection. Some great comics. Oh, my gosh.
That was really well done, Ryan, because I know that's the first time you've ever heard of in-stock trades.
Gosh. Mine is a little bit offbeat pick. I picked Swords of Swashbucklers hardcover. And this reprints a series that was originally printed as a Marvel Epic series. It went 12 issues. Well, all right, so here's what it collects. So then I'll back into what it is. It collects the original graphic novel, the 12 issues, and some bonus content. So what this was, it was this amazing epic story about swashbuckling pirates that are flying spaceships and going across this galaxy. And there's this massive scale war between them and these other sort of colonists. And it ends up Earth getting caught up in it. I mean, it feels a lot like Micronauts in some ways, but with all original characters, it was done. It was written by Bill Mantlo and created by him and Jackson Geis, or Butch Geis, whichever you prefer. They worked together on Micronauts and left Micronauts to come do this book. And I had the issues, or a number of the issues, for years. I'd never gotten to reading them. So in preparation for this episode, I just broke down and read the first six issues of this book, guys. And it is so stinking fun. Oh my gosh. If you like pirates, if you like space stuff, if you like explosions, talking cats and talking insects, and just a damn awesome, fun, entertaining comics, this thing is highly, highly recommended. So again, it was originally a Marvel thing, but now it's being reprinted by Dynamite, and it collects 496 pages, massive. Normally retails for $49.99. You can get it for 30% off, so it's only $34.99. So if you love Bill Mantlo, but you always lived in the Marvel universe, this is definitely the next place for you to go and sort of live in that Bill Mantlo crazy world. So folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Because, you know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows and Ryan's drinking problem, it takes a tremendous amount of money and hosting. And so we launched the Patreon a while ago, and you guys really, really stepped up to help. And I can tell you, if it hadn't been for the Patreon, this network wouldn't still be going. So thank you all very, very much. If you're enjoying these shows, please think about going onto our website and supporting it. And Rob, what's that website?
Patreon.com/FW Podcast.
Perfect. And if you go there, you'll see that at different sponsorship tiers, you can get recognized on shows of your choice. For example, our thanks go out to David Ace Goodyears and Gord Tolton. Again, folks, go to our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, we're going to discuss a few different stories here and just kind of, again, celebrating some of the things we love that Bill Mantlow has given us. So, Ryan, why don't you go first?
Yeah, I will. I'm going to talk about Cloak and Dagger, as I mentioned, but also, as you alluded to earlier, I did want to give a particular shout-out to another one of our podcast friends in the community. Shag, you'd mentioned The Incredible Hulk, issue 312, which was the Secret Wars tie-in. That is, like, one of the best comics I've ever read, and scripted by Mantlow, drawn by Mike Mignola of Hellboy fame. And it's really, seriously, like, one of the most important Hulk comics ever. I'm not going to spend time on it, but you listeners, go check out the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast. Back when Sean Ross and Greg Arujo, when they were talking about Secret Wars Volume 2, they did a whole episode on this one. And, it deserves to be talked about because this is an incredible story where Mantlow really got into the psychology of Bruce Banner and really dug deep into who he was before we met him in the first issue. The issues with his father and this child abuse angle that sort of fractured his personality and created this division where maybe the Hulk was there buried underneath the surface and the gamma explosion really just gave the Hulk a release in some sense. A lot of people credit what Peter David did during his like decade-long run of bringing a darker psychology to the Hulk and really getting into these themes of abuse and schizophrenia and Peter David deserves the credit for that, but what he was doing, the seeds for that run were built, they were planted by Bill Mantlow's story in that issue. It is a hell of a story. Check that one out. Incredible Hulk 312, and listen to the Secret Wars and Beyond episode that they covered that.
Well, Peter David even acknowledges that when he took over the Hulk book, he looked back to that singular issue. And, you know, I read it when I was 13, guys, and it blew me away. And I read it now, and it still does. It's just that good. It's that powerful. And it's disturbing, too.
Similar to what I did with when we did our Denny O'Neill tribute, I looked at the list of Mantlow's credits, and I thought about doing a Hulk story or something else that I had read, but I also wanted to take this opportunity to read something that I was unfamiliar with. And I actually didn't know very much about Cloak and Dagger. The first time I ever read them was actually in the Spider-Man Maximum Carnage crossover in the early 90s. And for whatever reason, that didn't make me want to read more about them. But I always kind of just – I had this sort of unfair bias that they were kind of like gimmicky. It's like Cloak, Dagger, he's into darkness, she's into light. They seem too gimmicky, like they like really one note, sort of like Hawk and Dove, who I do not care about. But I was like, you know what? Let me give them a shot for this. Let me read their first appearance. And the first appearance is in Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man number 64. And I did a little read up on how Mantlow said he and Ed Hannigan were the storytellers for this one. And Mantlow apparently created these characters after a visit to Ellis Island. And I was like, that was kind of weird, but okay. When you read the story, and these two are introduced as these vigilantes who are targeting drug dealers and this drug trafficking ring and everything, there's a plot beat where Spider-Man has to go to Ellis Island to investigate that this sort of shady drug experimentation lab was there. And Peter talks to one of the other city editors at the Daily Bugle, and this guy is telling him about Ellis Island. And there's this part here where he says, "You know about Ellis Island? Used to be the first stop for immigrants trying to come to America. It was called the Golden Door by the ones who passed the medical inspection. The others, the ones sent back to tyranny or poverty, called it L'Isola della Creme, the Isle of Tears." And then later, Spider-Man has to get to Ellis Island after dark. He actually has to create a web glider and float from the Statue of Liberty to Ellis Island. And on page 12, there's these three panels where Spider-Man is like climbing the roof of the main hallway in this Ellis Island building, and he's all in black. And in the bottom of the pages, there's this, I think it's like a Zip-a-tone effect, where Hannigan created these images of these ghosts, like immigrants that looked like a portrait that you would have been taken from like the early 1800s or the turn of the century or something like that, where you see people coming through the gates. And Mantlo's captions here. Entering the crumbling edifice, Spider-Man feels a chill inch up his spine. It is not his spider sense at work, but his imagination below him seems to be a parade of ghosts. Ghosts of the countless millions crowding through the golden door which they prayed would lead to a better life in America. He can almost hear the clamor of their voices, a babble of Irish, Italian, Middle European, Slavic, and Oriental tongues. He senses the contempt of the immigration official toward these masses. But over all else, he senses the pervasive atmosphere of fear. Fear of coming to a new land, fear of not knowing a new language, fear of foreign customs and of officials in uniforms, fear that the island doctors would diagnose the flea bites and coughs acquired on unsheltered and overcrowded ship's quarters as contagious diseases, thus barring admission to families who would rather die than return from whence they came.
Wow. So
reading that a week ago, I was like, shit. I was like, oh, that kind of feels topical and relevant. And that's kind of like, that's it. I mean, the rest of the story is sort of a superhero vigilante story. We return to Cloak and Dagger hunting down these vigilantes. And from there, like the story keeps going where he introduces Silvio Silvermane and we see him going from like this old geriatric with a failing body to get the cyborg body. So he looks like Abe Vigoda with the Terminator's body. And then Punisher comes into the story and like this whole cool saga of like six or seven issues before they get their miniseries. It was this really cool story. And I devoured these one night and I loved them. But this little three panels in the middle of this chunk where you really get this, and Mantlo says he was in Ellis Island when he came up with these characters. So something about that experience, he must have felt the sense of despair and fear of coming through these gates. And it gave him the idea of like these teenage runaways and this really dark and traumatic thing that leads to their creation. But just the text, reading those passages, I was like, wow, talk about an evergreen sense of the immigrant experience of coming to this land and the fear that you could be sent back to your own likely death. And even the fact that he mentions the contempt of the immigration official.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was just kind of blown away by this and, you know, forgetting what the rest of the story is and who these characters are, just looking at those. I was like, I mean, you know, this, like what we talked about with the Incredible Hulk story, with the getting into the parental abuse angle, Mantlo could dive into real themes, that struck at the humanity of these super powerful people. So I just thought that blew me away.
Everything you read, that was just in three panels?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, three panels.
And I told you, it's dense, really, dense writing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Imagine reading that in the bathroom. But then getting back to that, I mean, after that, he tells the lovely story of, you know, these superheroes, and he it's a slow burn figuring out who Cloak and Dagger are. We do not learn their origin story until almost the end of their four-issue miniseries. By then, like they had like half a dozen appearances in comics before that. So he really slowly doles out the information of them, and we figure out who they are. And Cloak is much more into vengeance and much more of a hardliner. And you know, Dagger, she's sort of sympathetic. And when Spider-Man is trying to tell them, he's like, "Hey, you can't just kill these people. That's not justice." And she kind of like plays into him, and but she's pulled almost physiologically to Cloak. And then you get the Punisher on the other end of the spectrum sort of to give them a contrast. So you're like, okay, they might be doling out, like they might be killing these guys, but they're not as bad as Frank Castle. So it's, yeah, it's really great storytelling. And that particular moment where he just takes a time out from the drama to just talk about this little immigrant experience that is as timeless in 1982 as it was in 1882, as it is in 2019 and 20. So,
and specifically to Cloak and Dagger, what a great creation those two characters. I mean, think about how much mileage Marvel got out of them in the 80s and the 90s, and even today.
They have a TV show now. Yeah.
Well, right,
they have their own TV show.
Yeah. Olivia Holt, hot, by the way. But the how much they were able to communicate about drugs. I mean, because, you know, that was the era of trying to tell kids that drugs were dangerous. And they used Cloak and Dagger a lot for that message. I mean, I remember reading Cloak and Dagger stories growing up, not noticing who the writer would have been. So I don't know if they were manual stories or not. But seeing those characters show up, and I always knew that I was learning something about, like, oh, wow, these are the dangers that face me. And they were a great platform for that. And it was a great creation, another wonderful addition to the Marvel Universe.
I had completely forgotten that he wrote the Cloak and Dagger half of the revitalized Strange Tales book from the 80s that they did with Doctor Strange. I was going through the cover gallery. I bought every issue of that series at the time. So I must have loved it because I had every one of them. And I completely forgot that he wrote basically like the first 11 Cloak and Dagger segments. I was like, oh, wow, I haven't read those in years. That series was awesome.
Well, I've got a Cloak and Dagger trade sitting on my shelf I've never read. And I just noticed right before we started, it's one of the Mantlo ones. I don't know if it's the ongoing or the mini or whatever, but I'm going to have to bust that out and get into that now, man. All right, Max. Now, it's funny, you know, before we get into Max, we started off talking just now about Cloak and Dagger. We're not going to talk about the Hulk. We're not going to talk about Rocket Raccoon. Instead, we're pretty much going to spend the rest of the episode talking about licensed or pseudo-licensed properties because this guy's a master at them. So, Max, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Human Fly?
Give it up for the Human Fly.
Whoop, whoop.
Okay, I have to admit, this is not a great character, necessarily. But I love the Human Fly. I mean, unreservedly, unironically, it only had a 19 issue run. I've got them all. I've got doubles of some of them. I buy it whenever I see it. I love this character. And it's a little complicated to talk about the Human Fly because, as you said, it was a licensed character and it's not licensed on a toy line. It's not licensed from, a novel or anything like that. It is based on a real life Canadian stuntman. And
rarely hear those two words put together, by the way, Canadian and stuntman.
Oh, don't criticize Boss's career.
Does anyone know where Siskoid was in the 70s? But at the top of every issue, it said the wildest superhero ever because he's real. And in the first, in the first issue of the Human Fly, there's a page-long text piece explaining his origin. And then in a later issue, there's pictures of the Human Fly visiting the Marvel offices with his sidekick, Mercury. And he was a stuntman. So part of his thing was that no one knew who he was. He kept his identity secret in real life.
Just like Siskoid.
Just like Siskoid. I personally have never seen Siskoid. And that's not true. And so that silence, I was like, people are going to think I'm serious. No, I have seen Siskoid.
I've shared a meal with him. I can tell you he's real. I promise.
And is he 60% metal?
I can't share that much.
And he, so his backstory as a real person is that he was in a terrible car crash, which killed his wife and child. And as part of his recovery, 60% of his bones were replaced with steel. And he could not move. He was essentially paralyzed because of his injuries. But through sheer force of will, he forced himself to move a finger, and then he moved a hand, and then eventually, you know, became this somersaulting powerhouse known as the Human Fly. And his whole purpose in real life, well, so supposedly, in the comics more than the real life. I think in real life he was just trying to make a buck. But he, in the comics, his purpose is to be an inspiration to other people who have lost hope, and particularly people who are disabled and who think that their lives are over, which might sound extreme to us today, but in the 70s was a very real thing. You know, if you had certain disabilities in the 70s, your life was very different than it might be today. And so that is how that tied into the comic. But his background is as a real person is crazy because, as I said, people don't really know who he is, even though in the January 2000 issue number 20, Jim Shooter confirms that it was a Canadian stuntman named Rick Rojat who kind of had a shady background that no one really wants to talk about, which is interesting. And he, what we know about Rojat is that apparently he was a sausage maker at a place called Roma Foods in Montreal. And the owner, this is being all pieced together from different places. The owner, Joe Ramassieri, basically wanted to get in on the Evel Knievel action and wanted to have his own stuntman. And so Rick Rojat, who was one of his employees, volunteered in a sense, because it's not really sure if he was recruited or if he was, you know, already someone who wanted to be a stuntman. And so they put it all together, and apparently Rojat was a bit of a character to begin with, because he was already telling people that more than half of his skeleton was made out of steel now, because he oh God, I can't even get this out. He had been mangled by a gorilla.
Oh my gosh, I hadn't heard that part.
Yeah. So he said that he was mangled by a gorilla to the point that he was put in the hospital and basically could not move, until that story changed once he officially became the human fly. And then they went with the accident story, which I guess they thought sounded a little more believable. And
this is like the story where Vanilla Ice broke both his legs and was told he would never dance again. And then suddenly he did.
See, and just like Vanilla Ice, it was a story of inspiration for the rest of us.
That's what launched Rob's dancing career, that's for sure.
And so, but he did make a bit of a splash in one of his big stunts was in 1976. He was essentially bolted to the top of a DC-8. that flew at a speed of between 200 and 300 miles. They can't agree on what it was. And he flew on top of this jet at low altitude, but, you know, at high speeds. And in 1977, he attempted a bus jump over 27 buses because he wanted to beat Evel Knievel's record. And instead, he broke his wrist and a whole lot of other bones because he did not make the jump. And even though he was on a rocket cycle with hydrogen peroxide fuel, and there's video on YouTube. Do a YouTube search for human fly, and you will see, because people have tried to do movies over the years. The last I heard was in 2012 was the last time I've seen someone really trying to make a documentary on the human fly, but it never goes anywhere. And so, but there is footage of these stunts online. So if you do a YouTube search, you can find it. And so basically his big splash was in 76. His last big stunt was in 77. And after that, he disappeared. And that jump, by the way, was in Olympic Stadium in Montreal. And after that, the human fly and Rick Rojat disappeared, never to be heard from again. And which is kind of interesting, because the Human Fly launched in September 1977, which was a month before his disastrous bike jump, and only lasted for 19 issues and ended there. Another twist to this story is that one of the rumors about Rojat is that after he gave up being a stuntman, he went to try starting a music career. And for one issue in the human fly starts his own music career.
Okay. So,
yeah. So that's
Bill Mantlow.
Yeah. And so he took bits and pieces of it. Like the bus jump is mentioned in one of the, because the fly has a crisis of conscience, of confidence. And that's because of his failed bus jump. And in the first issue, the DC-8 stunt is done, but in this case, it's being done because he's trying to stop a group of hijackers from taking over this DC-8, with whom one of the passengers just happens to be Peter Parker. And in the series itself, there are cameos by Spider-Man, Daredevil, another Mantlo creation, White Tiger, Ghost Rider. And, you know, and just all sorts of people pop up, and he gets into all sorts of scrapes as he tries to perform his stunts. And one of the things I like about it is that it's just such a wholesome character. You know, he just, he and his buddies, he has, because he has a staff, who is, includes his pilot, Blaze Kendall, who is an African-American lady, Arnie Berman, who is his PR guy, and Ted Locke, who has lost both of his hands from after they got blown off in Vietnam. So, you know, there's a lot of little interesting things that Mantlo kind of threads through this while all this silliness is going on. And I think that's one of the really interesting interesting things about The Fly is that it, for being so crazy, it still has one foot in the real world. Not to say that, you know, Rick Rojet ever fought Spider-Man that I know of.
Based on his story, maybe he did.
I know. I don't know what,
Where's the YouTube video of that?
You know, 2020 is the year of Tiger King. 2021, if they make a story about this Rick Rojet guy, this could be that. That could be the year of the human fly.
I will be the first in line. I would so be into that. And they, you know, so yeah, so it's just a crazy kind of thing. And it's almost always over the top. But at the same time, you know, there's it reminds me a little of Lone Ranger in a sense, in the sense that here's this guy kind of traveling the country and righting wrongs. And one of the things I like about it, and the issue that I wanted to point out is issue number 8, just because that's the one. It's a two-parter, 8 and 9, and it features White Tiger and Daredevil fighting Copperhead in the New York Metropolitan Museum of, and because why not? And he also has a rocket skateboard, which is awesome.
Yeah, he does.
And which he uses more than once, not just in his own stunt. He actually uses it. And you know, he you know, there's all sorts of things, because he's talking, he's trying to help kids and he's trying to give hope to people, and he's, and but what's funny about it is that throughout the 19 issues, the human fly insists that he is not a hero. He doesn't want to be a superhero. He just wants to, you know, do what he does. And somehow he just keeps falling into these things. And in the, even at one point in the first issue, Spider-Man even tells him, you know, oh, you're welcome to the superhero game. And the fly is like, oh, no thanks. but he keeps getting dragged into this, and he keeps performing heroically, even though it's not necessarily what he wants to be doing. And I thought that was kind of a great little running gag with the character. So yeah, it's the human fly has never, because of licensing issues, has never been collected. As far as I know, the human fly has never, ever made a cameo anywhere other, and he's never appeared in any other comic than these 19 issues. But you can find them. You can find them in if your store carries back issues, you can probably find a couple. It took me a while to get all 19, but it's, for me, it was totally worth it, because they are fun stories and I reread them all the time. And yeah, it's just crazy stuff. I mean, rocket skateboards and rocket skis and you know, deadly mechanical birds, and you know, he carries a pimp stick most of the time.
Yes, he does
all sorts of things. He wears a cape. He wears a luchador mask. You know, it's awesome. It's fantastic.
I in preparation, I'd never read The Human Fly before, but in preparation for this, I'd read issues 1, 2, and 8 and had a lot of fun with them. And they're not what I expected at all, because, you know, the name Human Fly evokes certain things, none of which you see in this guy's costume. He looks a lot like Captain Britain, like the original Captain Britain costume to me, because like with the red and the lines, and again, carrying the pimp stick and everything. So I saw a lot of that. But he also, I felt a little bit of Condor Man going on with, you know, Condor Man was the stunt man, the Disney movie, with the stunt man who wouldn't put anything in his comics if like he couldn't make it work in real life, because he had like, you know, magnet hands to hold onto the plane so he didn't fall off, or he, you know, had all these gadgets, which I thought were great. But you mentioned something I really liked about the character, which was he did have that Lone Ranger feeling, or as I, what I went to was more the 1980s adventure show feeling, like, you know, the A-team rolls into town, a new town every episode to help somebody out kind of feeling, or Stingray specifically came to mind, because the idea of he comes in and no one knows his real identity. So I really felt that. I liked that. And then one thing specifically you talked about, he finds himself in these situations of helping people. In number 8, there's a scene where Copperhead's running around, right? And everyone's like, hey, hey, Human Fly, go stop Copperhead. And he's like, no, because he's there with a school of children. He's like, no, kids, I have to take care of you first. You're my first priority. He says it like three times. And he gets the kids to safety. And the minute they're in safety, he's on that rocket skateboard and he's off to action to go say, you know, stop the bad guy. So I just really like that he takes the time to protect the kids first. I just thought that was a really nice aspect.
Rob, do you remember the Spider-Man and Ghost Rider team up when they went up against the orb in the stunt show?
I haven't committed to memory, yes.
I would love to see the Human Fly interact with that setup in that story. That would have been awesome.
It would have been great. I have never read a Human Fly comic, but Max has completely sold me on this. And partly just because it looks crazy. And again, it's Bill Mantlo probably taking on an assignment that nobody else wanted. You know, he's just like, all right, I'll do it. How do I make this fun for myself? But also, as I was going through Mike's Amazing World, I see that pretty much the entire series was either drawn by Frank Robbins or Lee Elias, who I am a big, because of course, Lee Elias Shag drew all the segments of Ultra the Monster.
I did not put that together.
Yes, I am completely sold on the series. So I am hoping, everybody, that this episode will work as a backdoor pilot for Max's future Human Fly podcast.
Don't tempt me, because I could totally do it. And no, Carmen Infantino also draws an issue. But yeah, it's for me, Lee Elias is really... This is going to sound... I caught myself before I said it. He is the Human Fly artist. So, but yeah, he is... I mean, it looks great. It's a great-looking comic. I mean, and like Rob said, it is a lot of fun. It is crazy. And it's... it's totally worth reading.
It looks like a blast. It really does. It just looks like one of those crazy Marvel series that, as you said, Max, like, it's kind of a lo-fi concept, because nowadays you'd be like, hey, he's a stuntman that has his own – you're like, really? That's it? Mm-hmm. That's his whole thing? Like, what's the big deal? But it just looks really fun. It just looks like he's infused with all the Marvel craziness of the 1970s.
It really is. And, you know, and also, if you have any kind of inclination toward you know, going down rabbit holes on the internet, oh boy, can you go down this rabbit hole? there is some crazy stuff out there about the Human Fly, and on YouTube also. I mentioned that little 8-minute piece of a planned documentary, but there's also his appearance on That's Incredible. If anyone remembers that show,
absolutely.
They did a segment of him on That's Incredible for his DC.
Skip Stevenson.
Yeah, for his DC-8 stunt, and he also did an interview on Canadian television. So all that's out there. Go look it up.
Hey, take off, eh? I'm the Human Fly, eh?
See, now I know Max is just making up stuff, because everyone knows there is no Canadian television. All right, well, from one slightly unstable licensed property to another, Rob, why don't you tell us about ROM, the Space Knight?
Yeah, I have never read an issue of ROM. In fact, I've never heard of ROM before this podcast. and I'm taking Ryan's joke and running with it. So, but no, I've never read a
ROM. I've got other material.
Oh, do you? Oh, okay. Well, why don't you try out some of it?
That'd be a first.
So I've never read a ROM comic. I didn't know that Bill Mantlo wrote it. So I was like, oh, here's my chance. But I know that ROM is very beloved by a lot of people. It's over at IDW now. Chris Ryall is like the biggest ROM fan I know. He actually has like a ROM helmet that he had made or something. Like, he's like a mega fan. And I've never read this comic. I never had the toy. And I thought, well, oh, cool. But Mantlo wrote the first issue. That's pretty cool. So I read the first issue, and I wrote a very brief plot synopsis of what goes on in the story, and I'll get into it a little bit. He says, the story is called Arrival. It's by Bill Mantlo, and it's drawn by Sal Buscema. It opens with the mysterious being known as ROM crashing to Earth and safely emerging from a blazing inferno. He immediately is almost struck by a car driven by a human woman named Brandy Clark. He saves her using his energy analyzer. ROM determines Brandy is a human woman. He then flies away. He goes to a small town in West Virginia and quickly seeks out two people, and using his neutralizer, kills them. Brandy arrives in town. ROM recognizes her and takes her to the outskirts of the town. Meanwhile, the officials of Clareton call in the National Guard for assistance battling this killer robot. When he's alone with Brandy, ROM uses another device, his translator, to communicate with her. He explains that those two people he neutralized were not humans, but were space-shifting dire wraiths. He then explains his origins to Brandy. He comes from the planet Galador, where he and others were transformed into cyborgs to fight the Dire Wraiths. After a great victory, Rom says that their mission isn't over until the last of the Dire Wraiths have been hunted to the very ends of the galaxy and cast into limbo. So he's now tracked some of the Dire Wraiths to Earth. He further explains that his neutralizer doesn't kill the Dire Wraiths, but simply casts them into a phantom dimension. The National Guard attack Rom, but he manages to fight them off. Rom then turns his neutralizer on three of the leaders of the townspeople. It turns out these three were disguised Dire Wraiths. Another Dire Wraith gets away and contacts the others on Earth, warning them that Rom has arrived on Earth and is hunting them. Now, the reason I got into this whole detail of this particular story is, like with Human Fly, this was probably a thankless assignment, right? This comic, because it's a toy that was a bomb pretty much right from the get-go, because it was Parker Brothers who made board games getting into the toy robot business. And they didn't give any villains for Rom to fight in the toy. Like, you just bought Rom. So, I mean, I don't know what you're supposed to do with him.
His eyes lit up.
But, I mean, it's like, and he's gray. Like, it's a really dull toy. So imagine, you know, and he has no face. So it's like, imagine, you know, here, write this.
And doesn't he have, like, almost zero articulation?
Right, yeah. I mean, the toy was a giant flop. And so poor Bill Mantlo must have been like, how am I going to make a series out of this? Well, the premise that he came up with, and I know that apparently he was assisted by Jim Shooter on this. The editor of the series, Joe Duffy, has said as much in an interview. But that the setup for this is so good. Like, I was reading it. I'm like, wow, this is such a great way to build something out of nothing. Is that he turned this thing into like, oh, this guy purposely was transformed into this killer robot just to hunt the Dire Wraiths. And it's really like the show The Invaders, the 1960 TV show The Invaders, where it's like this secret armada is invading Earth. They can change shape. And I was like, this is so amazing. So again, I've never read a Rom comic. Rom lasted 75 issues plus an annual. And I was shocked to learn Bill Mantlo wrote every one of them. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them. I had no idea. And I'm like, not only did he take this toy property that just went nowhere. It was the toy's probably off the shelves by like issue 12 of the series. But then they managed to build this thing that had ran for 75 issues. So I want to read more of these because the setup is classic sci-fi. The Dire Wraiths are a cool idea. They're basically like the Skrulls. I mean, they're just like shape-shifting Skrulls. But he really manages to do a lot with it, and I really thoroughly enjoyed this first issue of Rom.
It's interesting. You know, I don't know if the toy – I don't know enough here about whether the toy line was a flop or not. I thought it was mildly successful. I mean, I shouldn't say toy line. Toy.
There was no toy line. It was $1.
But I do know how beloved this character is. I mean, a buddy of mine who's a cosplayer. His name's Alan. He heads up a lot of the different groups that do cosplaying. He showed up at Dragon Con in a Rom full suit, like VacuSeal, chrome, high shine. He couldn't walk more than 1 foot at Dragon Con without somebody stopping him, begging to take their picture with him for the entire day he was wearing it. That's how popular Rom is. That's all these years later. People love this series. Oh my gosh. So, and also, you know, you mentioned the Dire Wraiths and things like that. They were so interesting that Chris Claremont picked them up and made them kind of a running concern in the X-Men for a while.
Yeah, I mean, they worked Spider-Man, like Rom appeared in other series and stuff. I mean, it's like, and it's never been reprinted because of the rights thing, because IDW has the current rights to it. But just the idea that you would take this toy line that nobody remembers and build a series that ran that long out of it, that's so impressive.
You know, and I have to say, I haven't read every Rom comic. I've read a lot of Rom comics. And for me, Rom was my Silver Surfer. You know, he was my cosmic hero, and I think Mantlo was in parts kind of channeling Jack Kirby, because, you know, it has that florid kind of language and it's all these epic speeches and that sort of thing. But, you know, that's what grabbed me. And I know that I did not read the first I heard of Rom was like what Rob was saying, was the Dire Wraiths popping up in other stories. Probably X-Men, if thinking about it. And then Rom probably showed up in a later issue and, you know, vaporized them. And it was, and that for me was like an awakening. I was like, who is this guy? Because it is just so, it's just so epic. And Rom is just, as a character, is so single-minded in his duty. It's a really interesting read.
There's a point in the comic, and I'm assuming this was a Bill Mantlo touch, not a Sal Buscema touch, where they're in the town and they're in front of like an old-timey movie theater, and you see the marquee and it says Creature from Space. And to me, that's what Mantlo is doing. He is totally writing a 1950s sci-fi invasion thing, but set in the 1978 Marvel Universe. And so to me, he just completely channeled that feeling. And I really kind of want to read more issues of Rom. Like Human Fly, it's not been collected. But I really want to read more of them because it's such a fun premise. And it really is kind of making a mountain out of a molehill. You know, I am sure that when Marvel got the license, they had no clue that they would still be publishing that series, like what, eight years later? It's kind of like when you mentioned that he created Rocket Raccoon. Can you imagine Bill Mantlo as he's writing this character saying, I'm going to have a talking raccoon that shoots guns. Oh, he'll be in a movie one day. Imagine that. So I just think that's so impressive that he could take something like this and give it such life and then have such a run on it. I mean, 70, there are not that many writers that have written 75 straight issues of any title. That's very true. Really impressive.
And Marvel, even though they don't have the license, they do every so often try and grab a piece of it by having the Space Knights appear. And those are basically like Rom's compatriots, just without Rom in them. So I've seen a couple of different Space Knight efforts they put forward. So they still want to celebrate it because people love it so much. And I can tell you why Bill Mantlo probably got the Rom gig is because my pick, which is Micronauts, which and I'll talk about that in a second, but Rom came about a year after Micronauts. So I think what happened was they looked and said, okay, Micronauts is wildly successful. That guy could do a toy book. Let's give him Rom. I bet that is exactly how he ended up with the assignment. So similar to similar to Rom, where he wrote all 75 issues, Bill Mantlo wrote about 60 issues altogether. That includes some annuals and stuff of the first volume of Micronauts. The only issue he didn't write was the very last issue, which is really just more like a preview for volume two. Then what happens is he walks into this situation where there's a Japanese toy line called Micro Man, all right? And it's, if you guys remember in the 70s, apparently Ryan made it sound like the 70s was a million years ago. But if you remember the 70s, there was these little action figures called Micronauts, and you could take them apart and mix parts and all that stuff. Well, originally in Japan, they're called Micro Man. And the gimmick was this little alien toy you're playing with. In his story, he was supposed to be the same size as he was in the toy. So he'd run around the Earth at that size. So the kids felt like they were actually carrying him around rather than carrying around a representation. So Christmas 1977 comes around, and the Mego Corporation, right? Rob, I don't know. Have you ever heard of them before?
I think so.
So the Mego Corporation has licensed this Microman thing and brought it over to the United States as the Micronauts. Bill Mantlo's kid, his son Adam, who, by the way, was referenced in that Human Fly issue, by the way, Adam is opening his Christmas presents on Christmas 1977, and he gets all these Micronauts action figures. And Bill, as a writer, his mind just starts going and going, and he's like, these are really cool. And he starts coming up with this whole idea of a universe for these characters where they're actually that size. So he goes in to see Jim Shooter, who just got promoted to editor-in-chief, and he says, I want you to get the license for these toys. So normally what happens is a company makes something and goes to Marvel and says, hey, would you please, you know, make a comic book for us? In this case, it was the other way around. Marvel chased down the license. And a lot of this was because Marvel, a couple years before this, had been in real dire financial straits. But the Star Wars comic, which no one expected much out of, was obviously a massive success. And so Marvel, after that, they're like, okay, Star Wars saved the company. So we're chasing every licensing thing we can. And so they went after Micronauts. They got it. And Bill, along with Michael Golden, had to build the entire mythos for these characters. Because, again, they were just little plastic toys that were no offense, folks, that had the toys. They're like shapeless blobs as far as I was concerned. I was never very impressed with them. But him and Michael Golden sit down. They come up with the backstory, the mythology, the personalities, alphabet, everything. All they really had to work with was maybe a color of the character and their name. And they built everything from there. And it's astonishing, this world they built. Now, we're giving shout-outs earlier to Secret Wars podcast. I also want to give a shout-out to Ben Avery, our buddy who does the Comic Book Time Machine podcast. He's been covering a lot of licensed books over there, and he's been covering Micronauts, which has been really great. So what I want to do is I'm going to give you a real quick recap of Micronauts number one and Micronauts number two, and then I want to talk about sort of the world he created here. So issue number one, the story, again, it's Michael Golden and Bill Mantlo. The story opens following the rightful prince and princess of the Microverse as they are being hunted by revolutionaries. The aristocracy has just been overthrown by the evil Baron Karza, who has promised the citizens immortality via his body banks. The prince is captured, but the princess, who is later called Marionette, escapes with the help of a mysterious being called the Time Traveler. Later we meet Commander Ran and his robot Biotron as they return to the homeworld after 1,000 years of exploring the Microverse. Baron Karza and Commander Ran, Baron Karza has Commander Ran thrown into a dungeon because Karza fears something Commander Ran may have discovered in his journeys. And from the dungeon and later to the Colosseum Games, we're introduced to our other heroes, Acroyer, Bug, Marionette, and Microtron. Together, they break out of the Colosseum and escape in Commander Ran's ship. They're hunted by Karza's soldiers, which include Acroyer's own brother, and they fly the ship through the fringes of the Microverse and then escape through the space wall into what mysteries lie beyond, someplace called Earth. Now, guys, that is a super, super brief summary because this thing is so freaking dense and so full of mythology, it'll blow your mind when you read it. Now, I really wanted to read the recap of number two because that really – number one creates the world. Number two sets up the premise for how the series goes. So as our heroes depart the Microverse, they're being chased by a courier's brother. They enter normal space and promptly crash land on this strange new world full of giant-sized vegetation. And as the crew leaves the ship to explore this new planet that's rich in fauna, they encounter an enormous metallic structure and a huge furry beast comes charging towards them. Well, the camera pulls back and we, the reader, recognizes that this giant metal structure is actually a backyard swing set. And the charging beast is this adorable puppy named Muffin. So the Micronauts have landed near Daytona Beach, Florida, of course, in the backyard of a suburban home. However, the Micronauts find that they're only about 4 inches tall. And that is, for you toy collectors out there, let's be specific, they're 3.75 inches tall, as we all know. And our heroes mistake the puppy for a raging beast. So Microtron, Biotron, and Commander Ran incapacitate the furry canine. Meanwhile, Acroyer and Bug do battle with the destructive machine known as the Lawnmower. Now, conceptually, it's all quite comical. There's a lot of laughs in here because of the size differences and stuff, but it's rendered really dynamic and really exciting. So the human boy, he was mowing the grass, and his name is Stephen Coffin. He agrees to help the Micronauts. And about this time, the evil pursuers arrive from the Microverse. This huge fight ensues, and the Micronauts escape in their own ship while the young boy Steve takes out the final evil ship with a garden rake. And now, alone in the yard, full of flames and destruction, Steve says, "Gee, what am I going to tell Dad?" So it sets up this fun premise where the Micronauts are teeny tiny in our world. But there is so much in here. Now, you guys talked about topical. Man, all right, this thing's full of, like, the bad guy. There's all kinds of riots. People are rebelling against the people in power, and the soldiers are putting them down. The ruler's throwing out bread and circuses to distract them. And he says, just give them that, and they'll shut up. I mean, it feels very topical in a lot of ways. But there's also these huge space fantasy concepts in here. You've got the aristocracy being overthrown by a chief scientist. You got the heroes of the rebellion. A lot of echoes in Star Wars in there. You got the submolecular solar system and the body banks. This is really crazy. So you get immortality by replacing your body parts, but it's only for the really loyal or the super rich. So basically whoever agrees with the guy in charge. And they have these blasters that will destroy life functions, but leaves the body intact. And so you can recycle the body and use it for other purposes. Like, just sick and twist, taking away your free will, basically, you know? There's another idea I love in here where the main guy, Commander Ran, he goes on this 1,000-year space journey to go meet other aliens and stuff like that. And he's in suspended animation in between trips and whatnot. And by the time he gets home, turns out over the course of these 1,000 years, his whole trip was wasted because his society developed warp speed. So the whole time he's on this 1,000-year trip, they've been jumping all over the galaxy because they build warp drive in the meantime. So it's a lot of neat stuff going on. There's more I could talk about, but it is super fun. Have any of you guys – I know, Rob, you've read at least one issue of Micronauts. Has anybody ever read any of these things?
You know, this is a big dark space in my comic book reading. I have read some here and there, but nothing that I really can point to. But it's something that I've been meaning to read for a long time because people love this series.
Mm-hmm. It's super dense and so enjoyable. I mean, giant, giant, sprawling space epics. So it's just so much fun. And again, another one that can't be collected, really. And I cannot recommend it highly enough.
How many And you mentioned that that Mantlo wrote the first 60. How long did Micronauts run altogether?
Well, it went 58 or 59 issues, the first volume. I can't remember which either one. And then the last issue, and there was a couple annuals in there. And the last issue was written by the new writer who went on to write volume 2, which went 20 issues, which was Micronauts: The New Voyages. It was one of those comics also that was only after issue like 34 or 38, whatever. It was only available in comic shops. You couldn't get it on the newsstand anymore. It was part of that experiment. And really, yes. Every issue, I would sit down to read, and I knew I had a good 20, 30 minutes in here just to read it. And it was going to be this, beginning, middle, and end in every story, a huge, dense, sprawling saga, and so many science fiction story ideas packed into this thing.
Okay, so I need to ask. I know that Rom the comic book lasted longer than Rom the toy. did Micronauts do the same thing?
They outlasted it. Yeah. They were still publishing when the toy was done. So yeah. Now they started, I guess, technically later than the toy line, sort of, But yeah, they outlasted it as well. Absolutely. Wow. It's all down to Bill Mantlo. It's down to his storytelling. Because, again, he left. And now the New Voyages, while they're good, it only went 20 issues. It's something about Bill Mantlo's magic that he could propel. Sure, because, like Rob said, he's not a rock star, but he could propel the story and keep people coming back every month.
Yeah, he really built the world. He built enough up. Because I had some of the Micronauts toys as a kid, and I was never that big on them. But he really – I bought the
never
comic
that,
occasionally.
Never that big on Micronauts.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah. No, but he really did a lot with it. And just as a side thing, can you imagine how happy Mantlo must have been when – they assigned him Michael Golden to draw the thing.
Oh yeah!
Like, oh my God! Thank you. Oh my God! Yeah, but yeah, he really was. And you could see that. Of course, there were limits to how much he could spin his magic. Because, like I mentioned, he did like Sectars, and that didn't go anywhere. And he did Team America, and that didn't go anywhere. So he really did get handed some pretty crappy assignments. But when he was able to have the right combination, he could really get a lot out of it. And like I mentioned with Rom, I can't imagine that when they got the Micronauts license, they thought they were going to get 59 issues out of it and then another series after that. That was beyond their wildest expectations.
I mean, he's really exceptional at world building. You talked about Rom. I read issue number one myself of Rom in preparation for this. Micronauts, even the Human Fly to some extent. And then when I read the Sword of Swashbucklers, I mean, that's another one where he built this entire sweeping, story of galactic forces battling each other. He's really exceptional at building worlds. Now, Sisko is not here today, folks, but I do need to, in his honor, mention Bill Mantlo's run on Alpha Flight. He did about 40 issues on that run, which is, I think, just talking off the top of my head here, I think that's the longest run of any writer on Alpha Flight, actually. And he had some big shoes to fill. He came on right after John Byrne, the guy who essentially created the team, right? Mm. So Bill comes in, and he did some really memorable stuff. I mean, he turned Heather Hudson into Vindicator. Before that, she was the team leader, but not with a costume or anything. He made her the superhero. He really explored some interesting and very disturbing stuff about body horror. There's really a lot of that in the first run there. He tackled transgender issues here in the early 80s. He had Sasquatch, ended up switching bodies with Snowbird. So here was was what they called Wanda Lankowski instead of Walter Lankowski. And he was having to explore being a man who was inside a woman's body. And they really did it. I mean, now, did he address it expertly? I'm not really the one to say that. But at least he was trying. He was putting it out there. He's the one who tried to bring Northstar out and reveal he was gay. But Marvel stopped him. But he was the one trying to make that change and bring it forward. So overall, it was a really good run. And like any long run, it had its ups and downs, but there was more good than bad in it.
That's one of the things that surprises me about Mantlo, is that even if his stories, are self-contained in a way, they do have repercussions on the Marvel universe in general. Because I mean, the Heather becoming Vindicator is a big deal in Alpha Flight history. And it's just, just so much of, and Rom and the Dire Wraiths and he had concepts that were so good that they actually were bigger than his own books.
Yeah, absolutely. And piggybacking, sort of what I was saying before about how that particular issue of the Incredible Hulk 312 and the whole thing with Bruce Banner and his father and their abusive childhood. We've said that paved a lot of ways for what Peter David would do with it. That is still being farmed out and explored in the current Immortal Hulk series that Al Ewing is writing today.
Oh, wow.
Which, to me, I mean, I love that series. I think that is the best series Marvel has done in a couple of years. I can't get enough of Immortal Hulk. And it is dark, and it is horrific, and it is it's crazy. And he references that storyline and that dynamic between Bruce and his father a lot in a big chunk of the book. So yeah, that's important. And Rob, you mentioned how he wrote 75 issues of ROM and what a signature run was that. I just, as soon as you said that, I had to go back and check. He wrote almost that number of Incredible Hulk issues. His run of almost 75 issues. And he was writing them the exact same time.
Oh my gosh.
Amazing.
An amazing guy. Absolutely an amazing guy. Amazing writer. Created some wonderful, wonderful concepts that still bring us joy. So that's fantastic. And I think I've really, really enjoyed this because this gave me an opportunity to dig into things like Human Fly and ROM that I never did before. And folks, go out and find some Bill Mantlo comics. Try them out. Make sure you've got some time to spare because they're going to take you a while to get through. But that mantra of find your joy. I mean, right here, anything with Bill Mantlo's name on it, I know I'm going to find some joy with.
Yeah, I agree. It's joyful stuff.
Yep. So, folks, go out to our website. We're going to post some of the images from these books, just a few, out on our website in our image gallery. Rob, what's that website?
Fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Yep. And leave your comments on the page at our website. Go out there. Leave your comments on this episode. We want to hear your favorite Bill Mantlo stories, maybe your favorite characters, or maybe the things that you followed over the years. Anything about Bill Mantlo in general, or maybe you want to put your Rocket Raccoon fan fiction there. You know, whatever. Rob likes that kind of stuff, so that's fun. But that's going to do it. So, Ryan and Max, why don't you tell the folks at home where they can find you guys on the network?
You can find me on the Mirror Factory and Plasticast right here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Perfect. Oh, and Max,
that is such a coincidence. You can find me on the Plasticast. Well, you can find me right here on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to your next episode of Cheerscast, Max. That'd be great. And you guys know where to find me and Rob, so I'm not going to bore you with that nonsense. But go out to Facebook and like our page, Fire and Water Podcast, if you haven't yet, and leave us some thoughts there. Or on Twitter at FW Podcast. And every other Twitter handle is owned by Rob. So, folks, until next time, I don't know what else to say other than they came from inner space.
We were doing something called the Dreaded Deadline Doom, if some of you remember, where because books came in very late, instead of an actual comic coming out, we reprinted an old comic under a brand new cover. My mandate when I was put in the position of editor-in-chief was to get the books on time. To do so, I asked Bill, who was amazingly fast, but more importantly, amazingly good, to create the most incredible types of fill-in stories and brand new stories which would combine different characters, because every month we would get together and figure out what were the latest books, and we'd team up all those characters, whatever was going to be late, so that no matter which book actually was late, we could slot it in. And it required the strangest crossovers, and Bill managed to get them not only incredibly fast, but they were all good. They were amazingly good. From there, an assignment nobody else wanted, he saved Marvel with brand new material that was exciting, fun, and adventurous, and kept to the characters like nobody else could have done. From there, he took on yet another set of assignments, which were nobody else wanted, which was writing toy comics. And yet he turned ROM and Micronauts into the most popular books that Marvel had at the time.